Chapter 21. At an unnamed, unnumbered, nondescript building on Pinsker Street in downtown Tel Aviv, an agent named Ephraim entered from the sidewalk and walked past the elevator to a dead-end corridor with one locked door. There was no knob, no handle. He pulled a device that resembled a small television remote from his pocket and aimed it at the door. Thick tumblers fell somewhere inside. A sharp click, and the door opened into one of the many safe houses maintained by the Mossad, the Israeli secret police. It had four rooms, two with bunk beds where Ephraim and his three colleagues slept, a small kitchen where they cooked their simple meals, and a large cluttered workroom where they spent hours every day planning an operation that had been practically dormant for 6 years, but was suddenly one of the Mossad's highest priorities. The four were members of Kidon, a small, tight unit of highly skilled field agents whose primary function was assassination. Quick, efficient, silent killing. Their targets were enemies of Israel who could not be brought to trial because its courts could not get jurisdiction. Most targets were in Arab and Islamic countries, but Kidon were often used in the former Soviet bloc, Europe, Asia, even North Korea and the United States. They had no boundaries, no restraints, nothing to stop them from taking out those who wanted to destroy Israel. The men and women of Kidon were fully licensed to kill for their country. Once a target was approved in writing by the current prime minister, an operation plan was put into place, a unit was organized, and the enemy of Israel was as good as dead. Obtaining such approval at the top had rarely been difficult. Ephraim tossed a bag of pastries onto one of the folding tables where Rafi and Shaul were plowing through research. Amos was in a corner at the computer studying maps of Bologna, Italy. Most of their research was stale. It included pages of mainly useless background on Joel Backman, information that had been collected years ago. They knew everything about his chaotic personal life, the three ex-wives, the three children, the former partners, the girlfriends, the clients, the old lost friends from the power circles in D.C. When his killing had been approved 6 years earlier, another Kidon had worked urgently putting together the background on Backman. A preliminary plan to kill him in a car accident in D.C. had been jettisoned when he suddenly pled guilty and fled to prison. Not even a Kidon could reach him in protective custody at Rudley. The background was important now only because of his son. Since his surprise pardon and disappearance 7 weeks earlier, the Mossad had kept two agents close to Neil Backman. They rotated every 3 or 4 days so no one in Culpeper, Virginia would get suspicious. Small towns with their nosy neighbors and bored cops presented enormous challenges. One agent, a pretty lady with a German accent, had actually chatted with Neil on Main Street. She claimed to be a tourist and needed directions to Montpelier, the nearby home of President James Madison. She flirted, or tried her best to, and was perfectly willing to go further. He didn't take the bait. They'd bugged his home and office, and they listened to cell phone conversations. From a lab in Tel Aviv, they read every one of his office emails and those from home as well. They monitored his bank account and his credit card spending. They knew he had made a quick trip to Alexandria 6 days earlier, but they did not know why. They were watching Backman's mother, too, in Oakland. But the poor lady was fading fast. For years, they had debated the idea of slipping her one of the poison pills from their amazing arsenal. They would then ambush her son at her funeral. However, the Kidon Manual on Assassination prohibited the killing of family members, unless said members were also involved in threats to Israeli security. But the idea was still debated, with Amos being its most vocal proponent. They wanted Backman dead, but they also wanted him to live a few hours before passing on. They needed to chat with him, to ask some questions, and if the answers weren't forthcoming, they knew how to make him talk. Everyone talked when the Mossad really wanted answers. "We have found six agents who speak Italian," Ephraim said. Two will be here this afternoon, at 3 for a meeting. None of the four spoke Italian, but all spoke perfect English as well as Arabic. Among them, there were 8 other languages. Each of the four had combat experience, extensive computer training, and skill at crossing borders, with and without paperwork, interrogation, disguises, and forgery. And they had the ability to kill in cold blood with no regrets. The average age was 34, and each had been involved with at least 5 successful Kidan assassinations. When fully operational, their Kidan would have 12 members. 4 would carry out the actual killing, and the other 8 would provide cover, surveillance, and tactical support, and would clean up after the hit. "Do we have an address?" Amos asked from the computer. "No, not yet," said Ephraim. "And I'm not sure we'll get one. This is coming through counterintelligence." "There are 500,000 people in Bologna," Amos said almost to himself.
400,000, said Shaul, "and 100,000 of those are students." "We're supposed to get a picture of him," Ephraim said,
and the other 3 stopped what they were doing and looked up.
"There's a photo of Bachman somewhere, one taken recently after prison. Getting a copy is a possibility."
"That would certainly be helpful," Rafi said. They had 100 old photos of Joel Bachman. They had studied every square centimeter of his face, every wrinkle, every vein in his eyes, every strand of hair on his head. They had counted his teeth, and they had copies of his dental records. Their specialists across town, at the headquarters of Israel's Central Institute for Intelligence and Special Duties, better known as Mossad, had prepared excellent computer images of what Bachman would look like now, 6 years after the world last saw him. There was a series of digital projections of Bachman's face at a hefty 240 pounds, his weight when he pled guilty, and another series of Bachman at 180, his rumored weight now. They had worked with his hair, leaving it natural and predicting its color for a 52-year-old man. They colored it black and red and brown. They cut it and left it longer. They put 12 different pairs of glasses on his face, then added a beard, first a dark one, then a gray one. It all came back to the eyes. Study the eyes. Though Ephraim was the leader of the unit, Amos had seniority. He had been assigned to Bachman in 1998 when the Mossad first heard rumors of the JAM software that was being shopped around by a powerful Washington lobbyist. Working through their ambassador in Washington, the Israelis pursued the purchase of JAM, thought they had a deal, but were stiff-armed when Bachman and J.C. Hubbard took their goods elsewhere. The selling price was never made known. The deal was never consummated. Some money changed hands, but Bachman, for some reason, did not deliver the product. Where was it now? Had it ever existed in the first place? Only Bachman knew. The 6-year hiatus in the hunt for Joel Bachman had given Amos ample time to fill in some gaps. He believed, as did his superiors, that the so-called Neptune satellite system was a Red Chinese creation, that the Chinese had spent a hefty chunk of their national treasury in building it, that they had stolen valuable technology from the Americans to do so, that they had brilliantly disguised the launching of the system and fooled U.S., Russian, and Israeli satellites, and that they had been unable to reprogram the system to override the software JAM had uploaded. Neptune was useless without JAM, and the Chinese would give up their Great Wall to get their hands on it and Bachman. Amos and Mossad also believed that Farouk Khan, the last surviving member of the trio and the principal author of the software, had been tracked down by the Chinese and murdered 8 months ago. Mossad was on his trail when he disappeared. They also believed the Americans were still not sure who built Neptune, and this intelligence failure was an ongoing, almost permanent embarrassment. American satellites had dominated the skies for 40 years and were so effective they could see through clouds, spot a machine gun under a tent, intercept a wire transfer from a drug dealer, eavesdrop on a conversation in a building, and find oil under the desert with infrared imagery. They were vastly superior to anything the Russians had put up. For another system of equal or better technology to be designed, built, launched, and made operational without the knowledge of the CIA and the Pentagon had been unthinkable. Israeli satellites were very good, but not as good as the Americans. Now it appeared to the intelligence world that Neptune was more advanced than anything the United States had ever launched. These were only assumptions. Little had been confirmed. The only copy of JAM had been hidden. Its creators were dead. Amos had lived the case for almost 7 years, and he was thrilled to have a new Kidon in place and was urgently making plans. Time was very short. The Chinese would blow up half of Italy if they thought Bachman would end up in the rubble. The Americans might try and get him too. On their soil, he was protected by their constitution with its layers of safeguards. The laws required that he be treated fairly, then tucked away in prison and protected around the clock. But on the other side of the world, he was fair game. Kidon had been used to neutralize a few wayward Israelis, but never at home. The Americans would do the same. Neil Bachman kept his new, very thin laptop in the same old battered briefcase he hauled home every night. Lisa had not noticed it because he never took it out. He kept it close, always within a step or two. He changed his morning routine slightly. He had bought a card from Jerry's Java, a fledgling coffee and donut chain that was trying to lure customers with fancy coffee and free newspapers, magazines, and wireless internet access. The franchise had converted an abandoned drive-through taco hut at the edge of town, jazzed it up with funky decor, and in its first 2 months was doing a booming business. There were three cars in front of him at the drive-through window. His laptop was on his knees, just under the steering wheel. At the curb, he ordered a double mocha, no whipped cream, and waited for the cars in front to inch forward. He pecked away with both hands as he waited. Once online, he quickly went to Quite Mail. He typed in his username, Grinch123, then his passphrase, Post hoc ergo propter hoc. Seconds later, there it was, the first message from his father. Neil held his breath as he read, then exhaled mightily and eased forward in line. It worked. The old man had figured it out. Quickly he typed, Marco, our messages cannot be traced. You can say anything you want, but it's always best to say as little as possible. Delighted you're there and out of Rudley. I'll go online each day at this time, at precisely 7:50 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Gotta run, Grinch. He placed the laptop in the passenger seat, lowered his window, and paid almost $4 for a cup of coffee. As he pulled away, he kept glancing at the computer to see how long the access signal would last. He turned onto the street, drove no more than 200 feet, and the signal was gone. Last November, after Arthur Morgan's astounding defeat, Teddy Maynard began devising his Bachman pardon strategy. With his customary meticulous planning, he prepared for the day when moles would leak the word of Bachman's whereabouts. To tip the Chinese, and do so in a manner that would not arouse suspicion, Teddy began looking for the perfect snitch. Her name was Helen Wang, a fifth-generation Chinese-American who had worked for 8 years at Langley as an analyst on Asian issues. She was very smart, very attractive, and spoke passable Mandarin Chinese. Teddy got her a temporary assignment at the State Department, and there she began cultivating contacts with diplomats from Red China, some of whom were spies themselves and most of whom were constantly on the prowl for new agents. The Chinese were notorious for their aggressive tactics in recruiting spies. Each year, 25,000 of their students were enrolled in American universities, and the secret police tracked them all. Chinese businessmen were expected to cooperate with Central Intelligence when they returned home. The thousands of American companies doing business on the mainland were constantly monitored. Their executives were researched and watched. The good prospects were sometimes approached. When Helen Wang accidentally let it slip that her background included a few years at the CIA and that she hoped to return soon, she quickly had the attention of intelligence chiefs in Beijing. She accepted an invitation from a new friend to have lunch at a swanky DC restaurant, then dinner. She played her role beautifully, always reticent about their overtures, but always reluctantly saying yes. Her detailed memos were hand-delivered to Teddy after every encounter. When Backman was suddenly freed from prison, and it became apparent he'd been stashed away and would not surface, the Chinese put tremendous pressure on Helen Wang. They offered her $100,000 for information about his location. She appeared to be frightened by the offer, and for a few days broke off contact. With perfect timing, Teddy got her assignment at State canceled and called her back to Langley. For 2 weeks, she had nothing to do with her old friends undercover at the Chinese embassy. Then she called them, and the payoff soon climbed to $500,000. Helen turned nasty and demanded $1 million, claiming that she was risking her career and her freedom, and it was certainly worth more money than that. The Chinese agreed. The day after Teddy was fired, she called her handler and requested a secret meeting. She gave him a sheet of paper with wiring instructions to a bank account in Panama, one that was secretly owned by the CIA. When the money was received, she said they would meet again and she would have the location of Joel Backman. She would also give them a recent photo of Joel Backman. The drop was a brush-by, an actual physical meeting between mole and handler, done in such a way that no one would notice anything unusual. After work, Helen Wang stopped at a Kroger store in Bethesda. She walked to the end of aisle 12, where the magazines and paperbacks were displayed. Her handler was loitering at the rack with a copy of La Crosse magazine. Helen picked up another copy of the same magazine and quickly slid an envelope into it. She flipped pages with passable boredom, then put the magazine back on the rack. Her handler was shuffling through the sports weeklies. Helen wandered away, but only after she saw him take her copy of La Crosse magazine. For a change, the cloak and dagger routine wasn't needed. Helen's friends at the CIA weren't watching because they had arranged the drop. They'd known her handler for many years. The envelope contained one sheet of paper, an 8x10 color photo of Joel Backman as he was apparently walking down the street. He was much thinner, had the beginnings of a grayish goatee, European-style eyeglasses, and was dressed like a local. Handwritten at the bottom of the page was, "Joel Backman, Via Fondazza, Bologna, Italy." The handler gawked at it as he sat in his car. Then he sped away to the Embassy of the People's Republic of China on Wisconsin Avenue Northwest in Washington. At first, the Russians seemed to have no interest in the whereabouts of Joel Backman. Their signals were read a variety of ways at Langley. No early conclusions were made. None were possible. For years, the Russians had secretly maintained that the so-called Neptune system was one of their own, and this had contributed mightily to the confusion at the CIA. Much to the surprise of the intelligence world, Russia was managing to keep aloft about 160 reconnaissance satellites a year, roughly the same number as the former Soviet Union. Its robust presence in space had not diminished, contrary to what the Pentagon and the CIA had predicted. In 1999, a defector from the GRU, the Russian military's intelligence arm and successor to the KGB, informed the CIA that Neptune was not the property of the Russians. They had been caught off guard as badly as the Americans. Suspicion was focused on the Red Chinese, who were far behind in the satellite game. Or were they? The Russians wanted to know about Neptune, but they were not willing to pay for information about Backman. When the overtures from Langley were largely ignored, the same color photo sold to the Chinese was anonymously emailed to four Russian intelligence chiefs operating under diplomatic cover in Europe. The leak to the Saudis, was handled through an executive of an American oil company stationed in Riyadh. His name was Taggett, and he had lived there for more than 20 years. He was fluent in Arabic and moved in the social circles as easily as any foreigner. He was especially close to a mid-level bureaucrat in the Saudi Foreign Ministry office, and over late afternoon tea, he told him that his company had once been represented by Joel Backman. Further, and much more important, Taggett claimed to know where Backman was hiding. 5 hours later, Taggett was awakened by a buzzing doorbell. Three young gentlemen in business suits pushed their way into his apartment and demanded a few moments of his time. They apologized, explained that they were some branch of the Saudi police and really needed to talk. When pressed, Taggett reluctantly passed on the information he had been coached to disclose. Joel Backman was hiding in Bologna, Italy, under a different name. That was all he knew. Could he find out more, they asked. Perhaps. They asked him if he would leave the next morning, return to his company's headquarters in New York, and dig for more information about Backman. It was very important to the Saudi government and the royal family. Taggett agreed to do so. Anything for the king. Chapter 22. Every year in May, just before Ascension Day, the people of Bologna march up the Colle della Guardia from the Saragozza Gate along the longest continuous arcade in the world, through all 666 arches and past all 15 chapels, to the summit, to the Santuario di San Luca. In the sanctuary, they remove their Madonna and proceed back down to the city, where they parade her through the crowded streets and finally place her in the Cathedral of San Pietro, where she stays for 8 days until another parade takes her home. It's a festival unique to Bologna and has gone on uninterrupted since 1476. As Francesca and Marco sat in the Santuario di San Luca, Francesca was describing the ritual and how much it meant to the people of Bologna. Pretty, but just another empty church as far as Marco was concerned. They had taken the bus this time, thus avoiding the 666 arches and the 3.6-kilometer hike up the hill. His calves still hurt from the last visit to San Luca 3 days ago. She was so distracted by weightier matters that she was lapsing into English and didn't seem to realize it. He did not complain. When she finished with the festival, she began pointing to the interesting elements in the cathedral, the architecture and construction of the dome, the painting of the frescoes. Marco was fighting desperately to pay attention. The domes and faded frescoes and marble crypts and dead saints were all running together now in Bologna, and he caught himself thinking of warmer weather. Then they could stay outdoors and talk. They could visit the city's lovely parks, and if she so much as mentioned a cathedral, he would revolt. She wasn't thinking of warmer weather. Her thoughts were elsewhere. "You've already done that one," he interrupted when she pointed at a painting above the baptistry. "I'm sorry. Am I boring you?" He started to blurt out the truth, but instead said, "No, but I've seen enough." They left the sanctuary and sneaked around behind the church to her secret pathway that led down a few steps to the best view of the city. The last snow was melting quickly on the red-tiled roofs. It was the 18th of March. She lit a cigarette and seemed content to loiter in silence and admire Bologna. "Do you like my city?" she asked finally. "Yes, very much." "What do you like about it?" After 6 years in prison, any city would do. He thought for a moment, then said, "It's a real city, with people living where they work. It's safe and clean, timeless. Things haven't changed much over the centuries. The people enjoy their history and they're proud of their accomplishments." She nodded slightly, approving of his analysis. "I'm baffled by Americans," she said. "When I guide them through Bologna, they're always in a hurry, always anxious to see one site so they can cross it off the list and move on to the next. They're always asking about tomorrow and the next day. Why is this?"
"I'm the wrong person to ask."
"Why?"
"I'm Canadian, remember?"
You're not Canadian. No, I'm not. I'm from Washington. I've been there. I've never seen so many people racing around, going nowhere. I don't understand the desire for such a hectic life. Everything has to be so fast. Work, food, sex. I haven't had sex in 6 years. She gave him a look that conveyed many questions. I really don't want to talk about that. You brought it up. She puffed on the cigarette as the air cleared. Why haven't you had sex in 6 years? Because I was in prison, in solitary confinement. She flinched slightly and her spine seemed to straighten. Did you kill someone? No, nothing like that. I'm pretty harmless. Another pause, another puff. Why are you here? I really don't know. How long will you stay? Maybe Luigi can answer that. Luigi, she said as if she wanted to spit. She turned and began walking. He followed along because he was supposed to. What are you hiding from? She asked. It's a very, very long story, and you really don't want to know. Are you in danger? I think so. I'm not sure how much, but let's just say that I'm afraid to use my real name, and I'm afraid to go home. Sounds like danger to me. Where does Luigi fit in? He's protecting me, I think. For how long? I really don't know. Why don't you simply disappear? That's what I'm doing now. I'm in the middle of my disappearance. And from here, where would I go? I have no money, no passport, no identification. I don't officially exist. This is very confusing. Yes. Why don't we drop it? He glanced away for a second and did not see her fall. She was wearing black leather boots with low heels, and the left one twisted violently on a rock in the narrow pathway. She gasped and fell hard onto the walkway, bracing herself at the last second with both hands. Her purse flew forward. She shrieked something in Italian. Marco quickly knelt down to grab her. "It's my ankle," she said, grimacing. Her eyes were already moist, her pretty face twisted in pain. He gently lifted her from the wet pathway and carried her to a nearby bench, then retrieved her purse. "I must have tripped," she kept saying. "I'm sorry." She fought the tears but soon gave up. It's okay," Marco said, kneeling in front of her. "Can I touch it?" She slowly lifted her left leg, but the pain was too great. "Let's leave the boot on," Marco said, touching it with great care. "I think it's broken," she said. She pulled a tissue from her purse and wiped her eyes. She was breathing heavy and gritting her teeth. "I'm sorry." "It's okay." Marco looked around. They were very much alone. The bus up to San Luca had been virtually empty, and they had seen no one in the past 10 minutes. I'll go inside and find help.
"Yes, please."
"Don't move. I'll be right back." He patted her knee, and she managed to smile. Then he hustled away, almost falling himself. He ran to the rear of the church and saw no one. Where exactly does one find an office in a cathedral? Where is the curator, administrator, head priest? Who's in charge of this place? Outside, he circled San Luca twice before he saw a custodian emerge from a partially hidden door by the gardens. "Mi puoi aiutare?" he called out. "Can you help me?" The custodian stared and said nothing. Marco was certain he had spoken clearly. He walked closer and said, "La mia amica si è fatta male." "My lady friend is hurt."
"Dove?"
the man grunted. "Where?" Marco pointed and said, "Lì, dietro alla chiesa." "Over there, behind the church."
"Aspetta."
"Wait." He turned and walked back to the door and opened it. "Si sbrighi, per favore." "Please hurry." A minute or two dragged by, with Marco waiting nervously, wanting to dash back and check on Francesca. If she'd broken a bone, then shock might set in quickly. A larger door, below the baptistry, opened, and a gentleman in a suit came rushing out with the custodian behind him. "La mia amica è caduta," Marco said. "My friend fell." "Where is she?" asked the gentleman in excellent English. They were cutting across a small brick patio, dodging unmelted snow. Around back by the lower ledge, it's her ankle. She thinks she broke it. We might need an ambulance. Over his shoulder, the gentleman snapped something at the custodian, who disappeared. Francesca was sitting on the edge of the bench with as much dignity as possible. She held the tissue at her mouth. The crying had stopped. The gentleman didn't know her name, but he had obviously seen her before at San Luca. They chatted in Italian, and Marco missed most of it. Her left boot was still on, and it was agreed that it should remain so to prevent swelling. The gentleman, Mr. Coletta, seemed to know his first aid. He examined her knees and hands. They were scratched and sore, but there was no bleeding.
"It's just a bad sprain," she said. "I really don't think it's broken."
"An ambulance will take forever," the gentleman said. "I'll drive you to the hospital."
A horn honked nearby. The custodian had fetched a car and pulled up as close as possible.
"I think I can walk," Francesca said gamely, trying to stand.
"No, we'll help you," Marco said. Each grabbed an elbow and slowly raised her to her feet. She grimaced when she put pressure on the foot, but said,
"It's not broken, just a sprain."
She insisted on walking. They half carried her toward the car. Mr. Coletta took charge and arranged them in the back seat so that her feet were in Marco's lap, elevated, and her back was resting against the left rear door. When his passengers were properly in place, he jumped behind the wheel and shifted gears. They crawled in reverse along a shrub-lined alley, then onto a narrow paved road. Soon they were moving down the hill, headed for Bologna. Francesca put on her sunglasses to cover her eyes. Marco noticed a trickle of blood on her left knee. He took the tissue from her hand and began to dab it.
"Thank you," she whispered. "I'm sorry I've ruined your day."
"Please stop that," he said with a smile. It was actually the best day with Francesca. The fall was humbling her and making her seem human. It was evoking, however unwilling, honest emotions. It was allowing sincere physical contact, one person genuinely trying to help another. It was shoving him into her life. Whatever happened next, whether at the hospital or at her home, he would at least be there for a moment. In the emergency, she was needing him, though she certainly didn't want that. As he held her feet and stared blankly out the window, Marco realized how desperately he craved a relationship of any kind with any person. Any friend would do. At the foot of the hill, she said to Mr. Coletta,
"I would like to go to my apartment."
He looked in the rearview mirror and said,
"But I think you should see a doctor."
"Maybe later. I'll rest for a bit and see how it feels."
The decision was made. Arguing would have been useless. Marco had some advice, too, but he held it. He wanted to see where she lived.
"Very well," said Mr. Coletta.
"It's Via Menzoni, near the train station."
Marco smiled to himself, quite proud that he knew the street. He could picture it on a map, at the northern edge of the old city. A nice section, but not the high-rent district. He had walked it at least once. In fact, he had found an early hours coffee bar at a spot where the street ended at the Piazza dei Martiri. As they zipped along the perimeter in the mid-afternoon traffic, Marco glanced at every street sign, took in every intersection, and knew exactly where he was at all times. Not another word was spoken. He held her feet, her stylish but well-used black boots slightly soiling his wool slacks. At that moment, he couldn't have cared less. When they turned onto Via Menzoni, she said,
"Down about two blocks on the right."
A moment later, she said,
"Just ahead. There's a spot behind that green BMW.
They gently extracted her from the rear seat and got her to the sidewalk, where she shook free for a second and tried to walk. The ankle gave way. They caught her.
"I'm on the second floor," she said, gritting her teeth.
There were eight apartments. Marco watched carefully as she pushed the button next to the name of Giovanni Ferro. A female voice answered.
"Francesca," she said,
and the door clicked. They stepped into a foyer that was dark and shabby. To the right was an elevator with its door open waiting. The three of them filled it tightly. "I'm really fine now," she said, obviously trying to lose both Marco and Mr. Coletta. "We need to get some ice on it," Marco said as they began a very slow ride up. The elevator made a noisy stop, its door finally opened, and they shuffled out, both men still holding Francesca by the elbows. Her apartment was only a few steps away, and when they arrived at the door, Mr. Coletta had gone far enough.
"I'm very sorry about this," he said. "If there are medical bills, would you please call me?"
"No, you're very kind. Thank you so much." "Thank you," Marco said, still attached to her. He pushed the doorbell and waited as Mr. Coletta ducked back in the elevator and left them. She pulled away and said, "This is fine, Marco. I can manage from here. My mother is house-sitting today." He was hoping for an invitation inside, but he was in no position to push on. The episode had run its course as far as he was concerned, and he had learned much more than he could have expected. He smiled, released her arm, and was about to say goodbye when a lock clicked loudly from inside. She turned toward the door and, in doing so, put pressure on her wounded ankle. It buckled again, causing her to gasp and reach for him. The door opened just as Francesca fainted. Her mother was Signora Altonelli, a 70-ish lady who spoke no English and for the first few hectic minutes thought Marco had somehow harmed her daughter. His bumbling Italian proved inadequate, especially under the pressure of the moment. He carried Francesca to the sofa, raised her feet, and conveyed the concept of "Ghiaccio, ghiaccio, ice, get some ice." She reluctantly backed away, then disappeared into the kitchen. Francesca was stirring by the time her mother returned with a wet washcloth and a small plastic bag of ice. "You fainted," Marco said, hovering over her. She clutched his hand and looked about wildly.
"Chi è?"
her mother said suspiciously. "Who's he?"
"Un amico."
"A friend." He patted her face with the washcloth and she rallied quickly. In some of the fastest Italian he had yet to experience, she explained to her mother what had happened. The machine gun bursts back and forth made him dizzy as he tried to pick off an occasional word. Then he simply gave up. Suddenly, Signora Altonelli smiled and patted him on the shoulder with great approval. "Good boy." When she disappeared, Francesca said,
"She's gone to make coffee."
"Great." He had pulled a stool next to the sofa, and he sat close by waiting. "We need to get some ice on this thing," he said.
"Yes, we should."
They both looked at her boots.
"Will you take them off?"
she asked. "Sure." He unzipped the right boot and removed it as though that foot had been injured too. He went even slower with the left one. Every little movement caused pain, and at one point he said, "Would you prefer to do it?"
"No, please go ahead."
The zipper stopped almost exactly at the ankle. The swelling made it difficult to ease the boot off. After a few long minutes of delicate wiggling while the patient suffered with clenched teeth, the boot was off. She was wearing black stockings. Marco studied them, then announced, "These have to come off."
"Yes, they do."
Her mother returned and fired off something in Italian.
"Why don't you wait in the kitchen?" Francesca said to Marco.
The kitchen was small but impeccably put together, very modern with chrome and glass and not a square inch of wasted space. A high-tech coffee pot gurgled on a counter. The walls above a small breakfast nook were covered in bright, abstract art. He waited and listened to both of them chatter at once. They got the stockings off without further injury. When Marco returned to the living room, Mrs. Altonelli was arranging the ice around the left ankle.
"She says it's not broken," Francesca said to him. "She worked in a hospital for many years."
"Does she live in Bologna?"
"Imola, a few miles away."
He knew exactly where it was, on the map anyway. "I guess I should be going now," he said, not really wanting to go, but suddenly feeling like a trespasser.
"I think you need some coffee," Francesca said.
Her mother darted away, back into the kitchen.
"I feel like I'm intruding," he said. "No, please. After all you've done today, it's the least I can do." Her mother was back with a glass of water and two pills. Francesca gulped it all down and propped her head up on some pillows. She exchanged short sentences with her mother, then looked at him and said, "She has a chocolate torta in the refrigerator. Would you like some?"
"Yes, thank you."
And her mother was off again, humming now and quite pleased that she had someone to care for and someone to feed. Marco resumed his place on the stool. "Does it hurt?"
"Yes, it does," she said, smiling. "I cannot lie. It hurts."
He could think of no appropriate response, so he ventured back to common ground. "It all happened so fast," he said. They spent a few minutes rehashing the fall. Then they were silent. She closed her eyes and appeared to be napping. Marco crossed his arms over his chest and stared at a huge, very odd painting that covered almost an entire wall. The building was ancient, but from the inside, Francesca and her husband had fought back as determined modernists. The furniture was low, sleek black leather with bright steel frames, very minimalist. The walls were covered with baffling contemporary art.
"We can't tell Luigi about this," she whispered.
"Why not?" She hesitated, then let it go.
"He's paying me 200 euros a week to tutor you, Marco. And he's complaining about the price. We've argued. He has threatened to find someone else. Frankly, I need the money. I'm getting one or two jobs a week now. It's still the slow season. Things will pick up in a month when the tourists come south, but right now I'm not earning much."
The stoic facade was long gone. He couldn't believe that she was allowing herself to be so vulnerable. The lady was frightened, and he would break his neck to help her. She continued,
"I'm sure he will terminate my services if I skip a few days."
"Well, you're about to skip a few days." He glanced at the ice wrapped around her ankle.
"Can we keep it quiet? I should be able to move around soon, don't you think?"
"We can try to keep it quiet, but Luigi has a way of knowing things. He follows me closely. I'll call in sick tomorrow, then we'll figure out something the next day. Maybe we could study here."
"No, my husband is here."
Marco couldn't help but glance over his shoulder.
"Here?" "He's in the bedroom, very ill."
"What's
cancer? The last stages. My mother sits with him when I'm working. A hospice nurse comes in each afternoon to medicate him."
"I'm sorry."
"So am I."
"Don't worry about Luigi. I'll tell him that I'm thrilled with your teaching style and that I will refuse to work with anyone else."
"That would be a lie, wouldn't it?"
"Sort of." Signora Altinelli was back with a tray of torta and espresso. She placed it on a bright red coffee table in the middle of the room and began slicing. Francesca took the coffee but didn't feel like eating. Marco ate as slowly as humanly possible and sipped from his small cup as if it might be his last. When Signora Altinelli insisted on another slice and a refill, he grudgingly accepted. Marco stayed about an hour. Riding down in the elevator, he realized that Giovanni Ferro had not made a sound. Chapter 23. Red China's principal intelligence agency, the Ministry of State Security, or MSS, used small, highly trained units to carry out assassinations around the world in much the same manner as the Russians, Israelis, British, and Americans. One notable difference, though, was that the Chinese had come to rely upon one unit in particular. Instead of spreading the dirty work around like other countries, the MSS turned first to a young man the CIA and Mossad had been watching with great admiration for several years. His name was Sammy Tin, the product of two Red Chinese diplomats who were rumored to have been selected by the MSS to marry and reproduce. If ever an agent were perfectly cloned, it was Sammy Tin. Born in New York City and raised in the suburbs around D.C., he had been educated by private tutors who bombarded him with foreign languages from the time he left diapers. He entered the University of Maryland at the age of 16, left it with 2 degrees at the age of 21, then studied engineering in Hamburg, Germany. Somewhere along the way, he picked up bomb-making as a hobby. Explosives became his passion, with an emphasis on controlled explosions from odd packages, envelopes, paper cups, ballpoint pens, cigarette packages. He was an expert marksman, but guns were simple and bored him. The Tin Man loved his bombs. He then studied chemistry under an assumed name in Tokyo, and there he mastered the art and science of killing with poisons. By the time he was 24, he had a dozen different names, about that many languages, and crossed borders with a vast array of passports and disguises. He could convince any customs agent anywhere that he was Japanese, Korean, or Taiwanese. To round out his education, he spent a grueling year in training with an elite Chinese army unit. He learned to camp, cook over a fire, cross raging rivers, survive in the ocean, and live in the wilderness for days. When he was 26, the MSS decided the boy had studied enough. It was time to start killing. As far as Langley could tell, he began notching his astounding body count with the murders of three Red Chinese scientists who had gotten too cozy with the Russians. He got them over dinner at a restaurant in Moscow. While their bodyguards waited outside, one got his throat slit in the men's room while he finished up at the urinal. It took an hour to find his body, crammed in a rather small garbage can. The second made the mistake of worrying about the first. He went to the men's room where the Tin Man was waiting, dressed as a janitor. They found him with his head stuffed down the toilet, which had been clogged and was backing up. The third died seconds later at the table, where he was sitting alone and becoming very worried about his two missing colleagues. A man in a waiter's jacket hurried by and, without slowing, thrust a poisoned dart into the back of his neck. As killings go, it was all quite sloppy. Too much blood, too many witnesses. Escape was dicey, but the Tin Man got a break and managed to dash through the busy kitchen unnoticed. He was on the loose and sprinting through a back alley by the time the bodyguards were summoned. He ducked into the dark city, caught a cab, and 20 minutes later entered the Chinese embassy. The next day he was in Beijing, quietly celebrating his first success. The audacity of the attack shocked the intelligence world. Rival agencies scrambled to find out who did it. It ran so contrary to how the Chinese normally eliminated their enemies. They were famous for their patience, the discipline to wait and wait until the timing was perfect. They would chase until their prey simply gave up, or they would ditch one plan and go to the next, carefully waiting for their opportunity. When it happened again a few months later in Berlin, the Tin Man's legend was born. A French executive had handed over some bogus high-tech secrets dealing with mobile radar. He got flung from the balcony of a 14th-floor hotel room, and when he landed beside the pool, it upset quite a few sunbathers. Again, the killing was much too visible. In London, the Tin Man blew a man's head off with a cell phone. A defector in New York's Chinatown lost most of his face when a cigarette exploded. Sammy Tin was soon getting credit for most of the more dramatic intelligence killings in that underworld. The legend grew rapidly. Though he kept four or five trusted members in his unit, he often worked alone. He lost a man in Singapore when their target suddenly emerged with some friends, all with guns. It was a rare failure, and the lesson from it was to stay lean, strike fast, and don't keep too many people on the payroll. As he matured, the hits became less dramatic, less violent, and much easier to conceal. He was now 33 and without a doubt the most feared agent in the world. The CIA spent a fortune trying to track his movements. They knew he was in Beijing, hanging around his luxurious apartment. When he left, they tracked him to Hong Kong. Interpol was alerted when he boarded a non-stop flight to London, where he changed passports and at the last moment boarded an Alitalia flight to Milan. Interpol could only watch. Sammy Tin often traveled with diplomatic cover. He was no criminal. He was an agent, a diplomat, a businessman, a professor,
anything he needed to be. A car was waiting for him at Milan's Malpensa airport, and he vanished into the city. As far as the CIA could tell, it had been 4.5 years since the Tin Man had set foot in Italy. Mr. Ilia certainly looked the part of a wealthy Saudi businessman, though his heavy wool suit was almost black, a little too dark for Bologna, and its pinstripes were much too thick for anything designed in Italy. And his shirt was pink, with a glistening white collar. Not a bad combo, but, well, it was still pink. Through the collar was a gold bar, also too thick, that pushed the knot of the tie up tightly for the choking look, and at each end of the bar was a diamond. Mr. Ilia was into diamonds. A large one on each hand, dozens of smaller ones clustered in his Rolex, a couple more in the gold cuffs of his shirt. The shoes appeared to Stefano to be Italian, brand new, brown, but much too light to go with the suit. As a whole, the package simply wasn't working. It was trying mightily, though. Stefano had time to analyze his client while they rode in virtual silence from the airport, where Mr. Ilia and his assistant had arrived by private jet to the center of Bologna. They were in the rear of a black Mercedes, one of Mr. Ilia's conditions, with a driver who was silent in the front seat along with the assistant, who evidently spoke only Arabic. Mr. Ilya's English was passable, quick bursts of it, usually followed with something in Arabic to the assistant, who felt compelled to write down everything his master said. After 10 minutes in the car with them, Stefano was already hoping they would finish well before lunch. The first apartment he showed them was near the university, where Mr. Ilya's son would soon arrive to study medicine. 4 rooms on the second floor, no elevator, solid old building, nicely furnished, certainly luxurious for any student. 1,800 euros a month, 1 year's lease, utilities extra. Mr. Ilia did nothing but frown, as if his spoiled son would require something much nicer. The assistant frowned, too. They frowned all the way down the stairs into the car and said nothing as the driver hurried to the second stop. It was on Via Remosella, 1 block west of Via Fondazza. The flat was slightly larger than the first, had a kitchen the size of a broom closet, was badly furnished, had no view whatsoever, was 20 minutes away from the university, cost 2,600 euros a month, and even had a strange odor to it. The frowning stopped. They liked the place. "This will be fine," Mr. Ilia said. And Stefano breathed a sigh of relief. With a bit of luck, he wouldn't have to entertain them over lunch, and he'd just earned a nice commission. They hurried over to the office of Stefano's company, where paperwork was produced at a record pace. Mr. Ilia was a busy man with an urgent meeting in Rome, and if the rental couldn't be completed right then, on the spot, then forget everything. The black Mercedes sped them back to the airport, where a rattled and exhausted Stefano said thanks and farewell and hurried away as quickly as possible. Mr. Ilia and his assistant walked across the tarmac to his jet and disappeared inside. The door closed. The jet didn't move. Inside, Mr. Ilia and his assistant had ditched their business garb and were dressed casually. They huddled with 3 other members of their team. After waiting for about an hour, they finally left the jet, hauled their substantial baggage to the private terminal, then into waiting vans. Luigi had become suspicious of the navy blue Silvio bag. Marco never left it in his apartment. It was never out of his sight. He carried it everywhere, strapped over his shoulder and tucked tightly under his right arm as if it contained gold. What could he possibly possess now that required such protection? He rarely carried his study materials anywhere. If he and Ermanno studied inside, they did so in Marco's apartment. If they studied outside, it was all conversation and no books were used. Whitaker in Milano was suspicious too. Especially since Marco had been spotted in an internet cafe near the university. He sent an agent named Crater to Bologna to help Zelman and Luigi keep a closer eye on Marco and his troublesome bag. With the noose tightening and fireworks expected, Whitaker was asking Langley for even more muscle on the streets. But Langley was in chaos. Teddy's departure, though certainly not unexpected, had turned the place upside down. The shockwaves from Lucat's sacking were still being felt. The president was threatening a major overhaul, and the deputy directors and high-level administrators were spending more time protecting their butts than watching their operations. It was Crater who got the radio message from Luigi that Marco was drifting toward Piazza Maggiore, probably in search of his late afternoon coffee. Crater spotted him as he strode across the square, dark blue bag under his right arm, looking very much like a local. After studying a rather thick file on Joel Backman, it was nice to finally lay eyes on him. If the poor guy only knew. But Marco wasn't thirsty, not yet anyway. He passed the cafes and shops, then suddenly, after a furtive glance, stepped into Albergo Nettuno, a 50-room boutique hotel just off the piazza. Crater radioed Zelman and Luigi, who was particularly puzzled because Marco had no reason whatsoever to be entering a hotel. Crater waited 5 minutes, then walked into the small lobby, absorbing everything he saw. To his right was a lobby area, with some chairs and a few travel magazines strewn over a wide coffee table. To his left was a small empty phone room, with its door open, then another room that was not empty. Marco sat there, alone, hunched over the small table under the wall-mounted phone, his blue bag open. He was too busy to see Crater walk by.
"May I help you, sir?" the clerk said from the front desk. "Yes, thanks. I wanted to inquire about a room," Crater said in Italian.
"For when?"
"Tonight."
"I'm sorry, but we have no vacancies."
Crater picked up a brochure at the desk.
"You're always full," he said with a smile. "It's a popular place."
"Yes, it is. Perhaps another time."
"Do you by chance have internet access?"
"Of course."
"Wireless?"
"Yes, the first hotel in the city."
He backed away and said, "Thanks. I'll try again another time."
"Yes, please."
He passed the phone room on the way out. Marco had not looked up. With both thumbs, he was typing his text and hoping he would not be asked to leave by the clerk at the front desk. The wireless access was something the Nettuno advertised, but only for its guests. The coffee shops, libraries, and one of the bookstores offered it free to anyone who ventured in, but not the hotels. His email read, "Grinch, I once dealt with a banker in Zurich name of Michael Van Tissen at Rhineland Bank on Bahnhofstrasse, downtown Zurich. See if you can determine if he's still there. If not, who took his place? Do not leave a trail. Marco." He pushed send and once again prayed that he had done things right. He quickly turned off the Ankyo 850 and tucked it away in his bag. As he left, he nodded at the clerk who was on the phone. 2 minutes after Crater came out of the hotel, Marco made his exit. They watched him from three different points, then followed him as he mixed easily with the late afternoon rush of people leaving work. Zelman circled back, entered the Nettuno, went to the second phone room on the left, and sat in the seat where Marco had been less than 20 minutes earlier. The clerk, puzzled now, pretended to be busy behind his desk. An hour later, they met in a bar and retraced his movements. The conclusion was obvious, but still hard to swallow. Since Marco had not used the phone, he was freeloading on the hotel's wireless internet access. There was no other reason to randomly enter the hotel lobby, sit in a phone room for less than 10 minutes, then abruptly leave. But how could he do it? He had no laptop, no cell phone other than the one Luigi had loaned him, an outdated device that would only work in the city and could in no way be upgraded to go online. Had he obtained some high-tech gadget? He had no money. Theft was a possibility. They kicked around various scenarios. Zelman left to email the disturbing news to Whitaker. Crater was dispatched to begin window shopping for an identical blue Silvio bag. Luigi was left to contemplate dinner. His thoughts were interrupted by a call from Marco himself. He was in his apartment, not feeling too well. His stomach had been jumpy all afternoon. He'd canceled his lesson with Francesca, and now he was begging off dinner. Chapter 24. If Dan Sandberg's phone rang before 6 a.m., the news was never good. He was a night owl, a nocturnal creature who often slept until it was time to have breakfast and lunch together. Everyone who knew him also knew that it was pointless to phone early. It was a colleague at the Post. "You got scooped, buddy," he announced gravely. "What?" Sandberg snapped. "The Times just wiped your nose for you." "Who?" "Backman." "What?" "Go see for yourself." Sandberg ran to the den of his messy apartment and attacked his desk computer. He found the story, written by Heath Frick, a hated rival at the New York Times. The front page headline read, "FBI Pardon Probe Searches for Joel Backman." Citing a host of unnamed sources, Frick reported that the FBI's Cash for Pardon investigation had intensified and was expanding to include specific individuals who were granted reprieves by former President Arthur Morgan. Duke Mongo was named as a person of interest, a euphemism often tossed about when the authorities wanted to taint a person they were unable to formally indict. Mongo, though, was hospitalized and rumored to be gasping for his last breath. The probe was now focusing its attention on Joel Backman, whose 11th-hour pardon had shocked and outraged many, according to Frick's gratuitous analysis. Backman's mysterious disappearance had only fueled the speculation that he'd bought himself a pardon and fled to avoid the obvious questions. Old rumors were still out there, Frick reminded everyone, and various unnamed and supposedly trustworthy sources hinted that the theory about Backman burying a fortune had not been officially laid to rest. "What garbage," Sandberg snarled as he scrolled down the screen. He knew the facts better than anyone. "This crap could not be substantiated. Backman had not paid for a pardon." No one even remotely connected with the former president would say a word. For now, the probe was just a probe, with no formal investigation underway. But the heavy federal artillery was not far away. An eager U.S. attorney was clamoring to get started. He didn't have his grand jury yet, but his office was sitting on go, waiting on word from the Justice Department. Frick wrapped it all up with two paragraphs about Backman, historical rehash that the paper had run before. "Just filler," Sandberg fumed.